From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Well, first of all, this is fascinating, Lynn. Did you know that there's about 17 million flies for every human being? And flies are the masters of survival and adaptation. Biologist Jonathan Balcom joins us to talk about these little pesky creatures that seem to invade our lives every year about this time, the little creatures we couldn't do without. His new book, Superfly and the Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Jonathan Balcom, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's great to be here, John. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. And one of the things that was just fascinating to me was that there's 100,000 papers written on the fruit fly, and there are 7 Nobel Prizes awarded for fruit fly examination. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the most recent of those 7 Nobels went to the 2 women, the American and the French woman, who last year won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the development of the gene editing technology CRISPR, which is almost scarily useful in the sense that it can be used to manipulate and insert pieces of genes kind of at will. I mean, I've not done it myself, but it sounds like it's a pretty user-friendly technology, and fruit flies have kind of become the darlings of genetic research. And the more we know, it's a paradox of science, the more we know, the more questions there are. So they continue to be very popular in the genetics laboratories.
And you say that there are maybe 1 million species that have been described, but in one of the YouTube videos that I was taking a peek at last night, you had mentioned that if you go down to like South America with a big net and you scoop up a whole bunch of flies, upwards of 95% of those flies have not been described before. And that's just fascinating to me. There's so much we don't know about our own world.
Yeah, it's a little sobering when you consider we've lost some 50% of all insects from the world in the last 50 years in terms of numbers. How many of those are ones that have gone extinct and we'll never have even met them to begin with? That's a little sad. But there's a much more human-centered and grave consequence of that. As we lose the biodiversity, it's a little bit like popping rivets out of a jumbo jet. You can only pop so many rivets for so long before a piece of the fuselage comes off, and we know what happens next. So we really need to stop poisoning the earth with pesticides. And we might do a good job to cut down on our lawn space and get some more natural gardens. There's a number of things people can do, but suffice to say that we really benefit from having these creatures here, that we couldn't survive without them. They would flourish without us, but the opposite is not true.
Well, Jonathan, you know, I would say that both flies and mosquitoes are things that we swat out of the way without, we kill them without a second thought. You know, I do give second thoughts to spiders and other insects. I don't know why that is, but tell me why I ought not, or maybe I still should swat flies.
Well, you know, I think it's certainly understandable for us to act in self-defense when we're being assailed by a mosquito or a horsefly or blackfly. I've certainly killed my fair share of flies. I sometimes give them a second chance, and there is evidence that actually mosquitoes become shyer if they're swatted at, so it may pay to be vehement in your defenses. But as a whole, when you consider the 160,000 species of flies and less than 1% of them cause any harm to us, and yet they're vital as pollinators and waste disposers, as members of food chains, then, you know, when we look at the world holistically, we need a much more salubrious, a much more tolerant relationship with these life forms than we typically have, especially if they transgress onto our properties.
Well, with 17 quadrillion, that's 15 zeros, living flies at any given moment, I'm just wondering. Well, obviously, there are so many. They're everywhere. And flies, you say, well, in the form of mosquitoes, are our number one killer. We couldn't live without them. And this just speaks to the biodiversity, right, and the circle of life. I'm wondering, first of all, could you tell us what the lifespan is of your average housefly?
The longest part of the lifespan of most flies is during the second major stage after the egg stage, which is the larval or maggot stage. That's when they do most of their eating. There are some adult flies who don't eat at all. Their primary purpose in life is to find a mate and make more flies. So I would say it can be anywhere from months to years in the larval stage, depending on the species and the conditions. If there's less food or the temperatures are colder, then lifespan tends to be extended. But adult flies, like your typical adult housefly, might live 6 weeks.
We had a pet fly, Lynn, in college. We called it the living room fly. And we put out as much food as that fly could consume. And it got to the point where the fly couldn't fly. It got fat. But, anyway. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with biologist and ethologist. That's a new word for me. Jonathan Balcom, who has just written the book Superfly and the Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. And I wanted to ask you, Lynn and I pre-taped an interview last week about sharks. And sharks have been around for 450 million years. They predate dinosaurs by 220 million years. And so they have evolved a lot more than we have, and we've been around for only 300,000 years. I understand that flies have been around for about 250 million years. What can we learn from the evolution of these insects?
Well, we can certainly learn that they are very nimble evolutionarily. The fact that they have very short generation spans, you know, the fruit fly can have 25 generations in a year. Somebody actually calculated that if you just took the 25th generation and if there'd been no losses in their numbers, no predators, no deaths, you'd have a ball of flies at the end of the year that would reach from here to the sun. So their fecundity is enormous, and their diversity is enormous. And we certainly learn a lot from flies through our genetic studies. But also, you know, we've learned that they're just absolutely vital to ecosystems. I just want to mention a little bit more about pollinators. They rank second to bees as pollinators. You know, we herald the bee, which is quite correct, as we should. But flies actually become the most important pollinators in high altitudes and high latitudes. And we depend on these creatures to do this because the foods we eat, whatever level of the food chain it is, the plants are critical. And those foods come from the efforts of these little animals that 90% of the flowering plants that turn into food we eat are pollinated by flies and bees and other insects.
And bees and flies are very efficient. Because once they visit a flower and they grab the pollen, they have the intelligence to remember where they've been and where they haven't been. And so they can efficiently go to the flower that has not been hit before. And I don't even know how you do this, Jonathan, but you talk about measuring the neurons, or not the neurons, but the intelligence of a fly by understanding that there's a drum that has symbols on it and it flips around, and there's this experiment that you were talking about. Can you take us through that a little bit?
Sure. This experiment's done in Australia on the attention span, or that show that a fruit fly has an attention span. And I think we can safely think of the fruit fly as sort of representative of other flies. So what applies to a fruit fly probably applies to most, if not all, other flies, and probably most, if not all, other insects. In this particular study design, they would tether a fly inside a rotating drum. And unfortunately for the fly, there's also electrodes attached, so they can monitor brain activity. And then the fly is buzzing along, flying facing one direction, and they put symbols on the inside of the drum. And as that drum rotates around every 3-5 seconds or what have you, the fly sees the symbol come by. And the brain activity, the burst of brain activity when that happens, and then another burst when it comes by again. But as it keeps coming by and the stimulus doesn't change, it seems to become boring for the fly. It becomes monotonous, and the burst of activity really lessens each time. And then if they suddenly replace that symbol, say a circle with an X, then there's another renewed high burst of brain activity. This shows two of the hallmarks of, or one of the hallmarks of having an attention span is that you show more interest in a new stimulus. And another hallmark is that you're not easily distracted by something else in your visual field, and that's been shown. You put a picture of a female fly to the right, say, that fly who's on the tether won't pay any attention to that if he or she is getting stimulated by these symbols in the drum. So they have brains. They have differentiated brains with different parts of the brain that do different functions. And insects and flies in particular have shown a number of cognitive skills, including mirror self-recognition, recognition of individuals, tool use, learning, memory, etc.
I just hate to think of a fruit fly having a longer attention span than I have, but I suppose it's a possibility. Going back to the fruit fly, this may seem like a really basic question, but they are so teeny. How do you physically, put sensors on this little thing to figure out their brain activity? How do you insert, to change their genetic makeup? They're tiny.
Yeah, well, this is scientific ingenuity, isn't it? We're very good at inventing tools and manipulating other species with them. And I don't know the answers to all those questions either, but I did take a tour of a genetics lab in Georgia while I was researching this book. And it was fascinating to see the tools that are used, but also fascinating to look at there were seven of them, fruit flies, who'd just been freshly anesthetized with ether and then dumped onto the stage of a dissecting microscope, and just to look through the scope and see the incredible, beautiful, jewel-like sophistication of the design, the symmetry, the colors, the markings of these little tiny creatures that are so easily dismissed and often disliked. It really warmed me to them, and I actually couldn't help feeling a little empathy for their situation.
That's great. So the next time you have some fruit flies on those bananas, those brown bananas that you have not made into banana bread, you ought to really take a look at them too, because they're lovers. They're great lovers, as you spoke of their fecundity and their reproduction ability. You explain in the book in quite some detail about their mating dance.
Oh, yes. It's always fun to write about sex when I write about animals. Flies seem to love sex. It comes in 50 Shades of Brown for them. There's foreplay, there's gift-giving, there's serenading, where flies buzz their wings in particular ways and sometimes perform semaphore displays, either at a female they're trying to woo or at another male they're competing against. And they also have very complex genitalia. Entomologists get kind of into genitalia, not because of some kind of lurid fascination so much as the fact that they are very important for identifying different species. Often it's the most notable difference between two very, very similar species. And those genitalia also play a role in species recognition for the flies themselves, which many of them, the genitals have to rotate 180 degrees after they lock in before mating can occur. So, yeah, there's some very interesting facets to the sex lives of flies.
Jonathan, I'm intrigued by sort of a movement the last 5 or 10 years about looking at animals as sentient beings that, and I think the litmus test is, are they self-aware? And if it's whales or sharks or chimpanzees, those sorts of things. I've never thought about our insects. You mentioned in the book that you're looking at the possibility that they are sentient. Are they self-aware?
It's an interesting question, and certainly I can tell you that self-awareness is regarded by scientists as a very high level of cognitive ability. So an animal who doesn't seem to be self-aware should not be assumed to not be sentient. That is, to have the capacity to think and feel, to have some kind of consciousness and to have some experiences. But yeah, studies with ants done by a couple of researchers in Belgium found that these ants appear to recognize themselves in a mirror. If they painted it, put a little tiny dot of blue paint on the front of this ant's head, and put it in front of a mirror, on seeing its reflection, that ant would behave much differently, would groom the dot, would sort of walk back, sort of almost regarding themselves as if they're going out to a party. Whereas if it's the control would be to put a little brown dot that's the same color as the ant, or a black dot, and the ant ignores it, doesn't respond in any sort of particular way because it cannot see the dot. And they did a whole suite of other clever experiments that, as far as we know, and the challenge here, of course, is that we can't get inside the ant's head and know exactly what they're experiencing, but as far as we can tell, they appear to recognize that that's me in the mirror.
That's fascinating. You know, you mentioned that flies are attracted to dead bodies, so they're helpful in establishing time of death and crime solving. Can you tell us some examples of that?
Sure. This is a field called forensic entomology, and it's a growing field. Because flies are so skilled, or certain flies in particular, blowflies and flash flies are the common names, they're so skilled at detecting the faint aroma of a freshly killed body, be it some other species or a human. They can detect that from up to 10 miles. They've seen some cadavers that are 18 years old and they've still got some living flies on them, or maggots. High up in apartment buildings, they get there. They find their way there. There's coffin fly maggots that can actually squeeze between the zipper teeth of a suitcase, and they'll burrow down as much as 6 feet to gain access to a body that's in decay. And then because they arrive so quickly or on a very specific schedule, we're able to, scientists or the forensic entomologists can calculate to quite a close amount of time, you know, minutes or hours, certainly hours, about when that body died. And that information has led to a lot of murder convictions that probably wouldn't have been solved without the insect data. And I'll add quite a few exonerations as well, and I describe some notable ones in the book.
That's just fascinating. Tell us what other great things maggots do. I mean, to me, the word maggot, maybe it's, what's the word, onomatopoeia, where it's just, it's such a horrible word for a horrible-looking thing. You see a maggot and you want to run the other way.
Well, one of the things that I understand how you feel. I can relate that. When we connect them with the rotting body and the bad smell and the often unsightly appearance, and sure. But maggots are really critical. There's a lot of animals feed on them, and they're a very easy food source. They don't tend to run away. And they do some pretty amazing things. And one of the most valuable elements to maggots for humans, which is something we don't really think of, like maggots valuable to humans. But one of the lesser known is in wound healing, where over the course of the centuries, doctors recognized and noticed that soldiers who had grievous wounds and had not been rescued from the field for a day or several days, they come into the operating theater and the doctors reveal the wounds, and they see the wounds and they're covered in maggots. It may sound gross, but those wounds are going to be in a lot better shape than if the maggots weren't there. The maggots disinfect, they remove harmful bacteria, they debride the wound, they help to clean it. Their wriggling stimulates circulation and bruise healing. And the maggots also secrete a substance called allantoin, which has antiseptic properties and helps to break down dead tissue and promote new cell growth. So the upshot of that is that to this very day, in fact, it too is a growing field. Scientists are using what's called maggot therapy for around the world in large numbers. Thousands of hospitals use this technique to heal intractable wounds like bed sores and diabetic foot ulcers, burns, bone infections, and the like. So it's quite an interesting and little known aspect of the way maggots can actually benefit us.
Mm, wow.
These are, of course, sterilized maggots. They've been, cleaned beforehand. They're very clean.
Right, so they're not transferring any bacteria themselves.
And that correct.
That was my question. I don't know if all young kids are told this, but I certainly was. I don't know if by my mother or who, but if a fly lands on you, they either vomit or defecate. That's what I grew up thinking about flies. So don't let flies land on you was what I was told. What is the truth about what happens when a fly lands on you?
Well, we're talking about the mostly house flies and their relatives, maybe fruit flies. But a house fly who's on the prowl for food, if they land on you, yeah, they have this marvelous mouth part called a proboscis, and it does have at least two gears, output and input. They can use it as a squeegee mop to put a little bit of liquid of saliva on your skin or on the tabletop or what have you, and that helps to make the whatever remnant of food or edible that's there, makes it imbibable. They're suckers. They don't have chewing mouth parts. They sort of hoover it up. They vacuum it up and consume it that way. And it's a very complex structure. And they can also taste with their feet as well. So as soon as they alight on your arm, they're getting a quick read of what's there and whether it's worth staying and feeding on.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Jonathan Balcom. He's biologist, ethologist, who has just written Superfly and the Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Jonathan, a couple minutes ago, you empathized with Lynn about her repulsion towards maggots, but you don't just empathize. You know this personally. You had some pretty nasty welts on your body when you were in Africa, and as it turns out, they were called African skin maggots that tunnel under the skin. That must have freaked you out.
You know, flies are entrepreneurs. They're always looking for opportunities. And I had read about flies that burrow under the skin and live there for a few weeks feeding until they pupate. They drop out and pupate on the ground. And some of those are much bigger than the ones I had. The bot flies are much, much bigger, like olive-sized. And I actually there are some curious scientists who've actually nurtured them and allowed them to live in their bodies and as a sort of act of curiosity and study. But in my case, when I discovered I had four African skin maggots, which are little creatures, living in my chest for about a week, I decided I did want to get them out, and that's not too hard to do. But some of the aspects of the biology of that way of living, it's called meiosis, is the phenomenon of fly maggots feeding on our living tissue. Yes, it's gross. It sounds disturbing, but it's just an example of how they get by in a complex world, and you know the interdependence that species show towards each other.
And for our listeners that may be traveling to some warm climates, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, what happened was you had a shirt on, and it was warm, and some flies landed, or maggots, or, you know, they dropped their eggs. Next day, you decided to rewear that shirt to get as much from that
shirt
as you could, and that's how you got in trouble.
That's right. I went for a run, and I hung my sweaty garments on the line in the sun to dry them out, and figure I could probably get away with it. I was lazy; didn't want to do the laundry. I figured I'd get away with another exercise if I stayed away from people. Well, obviously, the garments attracted this mother fly, which would have laid her. She would have laid her eggs, and that's right. The warmth of my skin when I re-put them on stimulated the little maggots to burrow in. One other note that relates to that is the bot fly. I mentioned them. It's another kind of parasitic fly that the larvae live under the skin of the host animal. They actually use mosquitoes as a courier, as a delivery service to get their larvae inside your body. So if you have to be bitten by a mosquito. So what the bot fly mother does is she grabs a mosquito in flight, deposits an egg on the mosquito, and lets the mosquito go. It's only females that are going to do the job because they're the ones that feed on us or another mammal. And then as soon as the mosquito lands and punctures the victim and takes blood, the little larvae crawls down the mosquito's proboscis and waits for the mosquito to withdraw and then crawls in through the hole left by the mosquito. Pretty ingenious stuff, if you ask me.
That's incredibly ingenious. I have to ask you this, Jonathan, before we let you go. You talk about the largest fly can catch and kill a hummingbird. Tell us.
That would be one of the largest of the robber flies. These are predatory flies who perch in areas where there's hopefully a lot of wildlife activity, such as other bigger insects, and they'll go after insects bigger than themselves. And yes, there are some rare cases of apparently one of the largest of these actually subduing a very small hummingbird. They have a stabbing mouth part and a kind of a toxic saliva that helps to quickly immobilize the prey. But I was as surprised to learn about that as you probably were.
Jonathan, we are almost out of time. Before we go, what most surprised you as you researched this book?
Oh, it's hard to say. Just in a nutshell, I would say, let me just give you one example. The fact that male fruit flies are more prone to turn to alcohol when they're rejected by a female. That just sounded so human-like. And, of course, they go for fruit, which ferments and produces alcohol.
What? That's incredible.
That's great.
Wow. Okay. Jonathan Balcombe is biologist and ethologist, has written fascinating books, Superfly and the Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. You have basically taught me that flies are unpopular, but that flies are important. And I'm going to pay more attention to them. I hope so, anyway.
What do you think? I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio, and continued success with your book.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks both for having me. Thank you both.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.